welcome to another edition of The Green Majority. I am your host, Darren Kaster. You're listening to Canada's All Environmental News Hour. We've got some fun stuff on the show this week for you. First, I'll be speaking at the top of the show just a minute here. Andrew Gregg, who is the producer, writer, and director of a documentary called Wind Rush, a look at the wind turbine controversy. The documentary takes a look at some of the anti-wind and pro-wind sides. It looks at some of the claimed health effects coming from wind farms. There have been reports here and there, unverified in some cases, as far as a study is concerned, unverified as far as effect. However, there seems to be consistent symptoms turning up, and they happen in different places, all seem to have the same symptoms. So we're going to talk to Andrew about what he has discovered and what he thinks is actually going on in this case. So that's obviously a hot issue because there have been lots of protests and this sort of thing. There was an example I remember covering about a year ago of they were going to be putting some wind turbines here in the Toronto area, in the Scarborough region of just outside of downtown Toronto, and there was about 300 people showed up at a public meeting to protest it. My interest in this subject is along the lines of the fact that I think there are legitimate concerns. I think just kind of going in, I'll sort of show my cards as for sort of how I feel about this, because I like almost everybody, there's virtually no data on this, so you're sort of in a situation of basing it on personal opinion based on what you've heard, because there really is a significant lack of data on this, is that there's sort of a knee-jerk reaction to it. Now, that doesn't preclude that there's an actual effect there, but it does mean that the people who are both for and against don't have all the facts. So we're going to talk to Andrew Gregg about what his opinion on this matter is, what he was able to uncover doing a variety of interviews and everything in his documentary Wind Rush, which will be airing next week. We'll be speaking to him in just a minute. Coming up after that, we'll be talking to Laura Tozer, who among many other things is the Director of Operations for Community Energy Partner Program. She just submitted a paper called Community Energy Plans in Canadian Cities, Successes and Barriers in Implementation, which is, of course, highly relevant to the first. We've got a little bit of a green energy theme going on this week. And then, depending on how much time we have, we may get to the story of cosmetics, which, of course, is borrowed from the amazing The Story of Stuff. You should check that out on YouTube. You can type The Story of Stuff into the internet and find their webpage. Really, really great. They're cool videos. We've been playing a couple of them. Depending on time permitting, we may get to The Story of Cosmetics today. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Andrew Gregg to the program. How are you doing, Andrew?
Hey, how are you?
Fantastic. So I've seen a bunch of clips from your movie. We have a little mashup of some of the just little brief clips from some of the interviews here. And I hopefully did a good job describing what the documentary is about. So where I'd like to start with this is, how did you get onto this? How did you get onto looking at the controversy between sort of pro and anti-wind factions, a highly volatile topic for some people?
I was actually approached by the CBC documentary unit to look into a story about wind turbines, basically under the banner, is there a chance that these things aren't as green as advertised? I was pretty skeptical about the time. At the time, it was about 2 years ago. We looked at everything from, at least initially, bird and bat mortality to whether these things deliver the power as promised, to all sorts of different issues. But what ended up being our focus was health issues because of the different complaints that were coming from rural parts of the province, where wind farms were going in pretty quickly. And so that's the line we ended up following, and it took us out west to Alberta, down to Texas, over to Denmark and Scotland and Maine as well.
Okay, now I got a bit of a mashup of just real brief clips from some of the interviews you did. We're just going to play it. It's about 2 minutes, and then we'll come back and because I want to ask you about the backgrounds of some of the voices, some things, and I think it'll give people a fairly good idea of sort of what you're talking about in the film. So
sure.
We'll just go to that, and we'll come right back.
Sure.
I think that there are people that are really suffering from having the presence of these windmills all around their homes or around their farms. And whether it's psychological or whether it's really physical, does it really matter? I mean, there are people that are not responding well to it.
If we were given a medication to a person and they were coming with all of these symptoms, the regulators would be saying, stop giving people these medications. in a flash, doctors would be saying, stop taking that medication. It's making you too ill.
Well, you're allowed to have a mortgage that is basically paid for by our windmills. And it meant that we could keep our farm in family and as a family farm unit, rather than selling off to a larger mega farm or corporation.
The real question is, do wind turbines cause noise? Yes. Do they cause sleep deprivation? Yes. Is sleep deprivation a problem? Well, of course it is. Well, therefore, we have a completely plausible chain of causation here.
I would not say, though, that I believe that wind shouldn't happen in Ontario. I think there's probably a way to do it, and I think that it's important to have wind development in Ontario. It's just probably, you know, there were certainly some missteps.
550 meters, I think I described it as insane, because you know there are going to be people being disturbed by having a wind turbine 550 meters from their house. If you go up to 2 kilometers, which some people suggest, then that will drop the incidence of issues with these things a lot, but you'll still have some people still sensitive at 2 kilometers. So ignoring that sound is a bit like visible light, saying, okay, we'll just look at visible light, so go and lay on a beach all day. It's not going to harm you. It's not going to, you know, you won't get sunburned. Because if you ignore the part you can't see, you're going to come to the wrong conclusion. So you have engineers making judgments about health effects and saying there's no health effects. And these people have engineering background and have no concept at all of what the real health effects are. I mean, they haven't come to the scientists who understand the problem better.
Had one of the experts from the Ontario Agency for Health Promotion Protection, who came up, he's the environmental in charge of their environmental division, and he said he'd never seen anything like it either. That so many people upset by these things. And very consistent symptoms. We need more information about what is this hazard so we can mitigate it. I'm not against green energy at all. But I don't think we should be injuring people, even if there are susceptible 5 or 10%. We need to know who those people are and protect them like we do on any other hazard that we know about.
All right. So some of the voices that we heard there, that was clips.
That was well done.
Oh, thanks. some of the clips that we took there, I'll just list off some of the voices here, and then we'll get you to tell us just about your experience meeting and speaking to these people. So one of the main characters in the film is Norma Schmidt. She's a registered nurse. That was the second clip we played there. There's Dixon Hammond, who's a rancher that you spoke to. Several doctors here, Dr. Warren McBee, Dr. Michael Nissenbaum, Dr. Alex Salt, Dr. Hazel Lynn, and Justin Thompson, who's the vice president of Joss Wind. So you got a fairly wide-ranging, you spoke to more people than just that, but that was sort of some of the highlights.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk about your experience, not even necessarily in the content, but just when you went to talk to these people about this topic, what was your sense? Are these sort of people who are, you know, very excitable and they're on a mission to stop wind, or are these people that sort of, you know, reluctantly accepting the facts? How was your impression of the people that you spoke to about this?
Well, I should say at the beginning, I was pretty skeptical that these things could make people sick. My approach, I grew up on a farm myself in southwestern Ontario, and my initial feeling when I first saw these things go up was, well, this is a chance for farmers to make some more cash. Depending on the type of farming operation, that's a great benefit, right? But then my wife's family is from up in Bruce County, and I had paid attention up there to the amount of wind farms going in. And I started meeting these different people that said that they'd gotten ill, particularly Norma. And once I followed their stories, it was pretty incredible how consistent the stories were and how consistently none of these people really had a dog in the fight about green energy or not. The thing about Bruce County as a good sort of area to go and film is that it's also the home of Bruce Nuclear. 80% of the people that live up there derive income directly or indirectly from the nuclear plant. So this is an energy-producing county. And that, as they say, the nuclear umbrella stretches well into Grey County and down into Huron County. So this is an area where a lot of turbines are going in, but people are used to producing energy. And I thought it was interesting that the backlash against wind turbines up there was so vehement. And that wasn't just the conservative rural Ontarian that you're seeing protest against these things. There's a lot of young people too that would in other circumstances be behind an idea of green energy. But this came in and really got a lot of people upset, strictly based on how they were feeling. But the turning point for me was talking to Dr. Hazel Lynn, the medical officer of health for Gray County and Bruce County. She's up in Owen Sound. And she, once again, didn't have an opinion one way or another on wind, but she couldn't believe the number of patients and GPs coming to her with the same set of symptoms saying that we're feeling sick. And that, for me, was the turning point when I talked to Hazel Lynn. She's a person that's worked all around the world. She's not. Well accomplished and very experienced person. And for me, that was the tip off to start looking into this a little bit more seriously, the health effects.
Okay, so I've got several questions just based on that. First of all, starting at the beginning of just your comment there, you said people didn't necessarily have a dog in the race, as it were, or horse in the race, I guess is the right analogy.
Dog in a fight,
horse in a race. There, I always get that sort of thing mixed up. And then you also said though that the majority of people up there derive their funding from the nuclear facility. So wouldn't potentially, just as far as sort of being clear, wouldn't potentially these people be inclined, or at least there would be plausible to be inclined against wind because it could potentially be a threat to their livelihoods? No, is that not?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, the new hydro corridor that's going up there from Toronto to Bruce County is specifically to bring more nuclear and more wind down to the cities in southwestern urban Ontario. So it's actually, this hydro corridor is actually encouraging both. Mm. So ideally, look at it this way. You could have a farming operation with a job at Bruce Nuclear and sign a lease to have a turbine on your property. That's a pretty good deal, right? Particularly that those turbines, nobody knows how much, there's gag orders on all the turbine leases, but some of these leases are pretty, they're getting, into the tens of thousands per annum. So that's pretty good. And when you speak specifically about Norma Schmidt, Norma's a very outspoken person about this. She was all for wind, and she says this in the film, all for wind when it first came in, no problems at all. And then she started feeling sick, and she's one of these people that has been hypersensitive to having these things around her house, and it's really just devastated her life.
Okay, so one of the things that's mentioned several times, it's used, it's spoken about both in the film, and it's also the line that I've been, when you're talking to some of the doctors in here that you've got, but it's also the sort of line that we were hearing a year or 2 years ago when there was very unorganized sort of protests. In that case, I could be wrong, but I feel like there was a link later made to someone sort of riling people up to go and do it. Like, it wasn't a natural uprising of people that showed up at that public hearing. Was the idea that, there's not enough research, we don't know. But doesn't that cut both ways?
I'm not quite sure if I'm following you. I know there was an umbrella group called Wind Concerns Ontario that certainly was rallying people up. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But there were also small splinter groups that were forming all over the place on their own and going to council meetings. And the different wind companies were holding information nights.
Mm-hmm.
So these people were going to the information nights on their own. There's 50 or 60 of them around Ontario. Wind Concerns is kind of... has been through a couple of permutations in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's as effective as it was at getting everybody worked up. But they seem to, particularly in areas like Chatham-Kent, they seem to be very well organized on their own. I think that you could say that I think what you're getting at with the research is that could it go both ways? I guess so. My point in the film isn't really about, for me, there's more of a meta argument here. It's not specifically that green energy is bad. I mean, I don't think that at all. As a matter of fact, I think anything to get us off the coal-fired plants, everybody would agree that's good.
Mm-hmm. And, I should note from what I've seen, just because I've seen obviously more of the film than anyone that might be listening to this, that I didn't get that impression from anybody that I saw in the film, that there was anyone who seemed to be out to get green energy.
No, and I have to, full disclosure, I stayed away from those people. Because
they do exist, I'm sure.
It's like anything. I've done films on Indigenous survival. I've done films on caribou herds. I mean, every time you get into something like this, you get both sides coming at you wanting to, once they hear you're filming,
mm-hmm.
Everybody tries to mold your argument.
Absolutely.
But I think for me, though, the point is that this is a technology, wind farming, that was developed in places like the prairies, And in Europe, the originally in places like Denmark and Germany, was developed with very small machines, 330 kilowatts. The original wind farm in Canada outside of Pincher Creek is the Cowley Ridge Wind Farm. And it came in the 90s. It came in small. There was a lot of community consultation. As it grew, more wires went in, and also there's a lot more space out there. So once the turbines got up to 2.3 and now 3 megawatts, the setbacks were not an issue because you could put them out in the middle of nowhere and nobody would hear them. What Ontario did when the government brought in the Green Energy Act in 2009 was saying, okay, we're making a commitment to wind power, and it didn't start small. It just came in, boom, with 1.5 megawatt, 2.3 megawatt machines into a rural patchwork area of farms that are basically 120 acres long and narrow. So the distance between buildings on those farms isn't that great. So it's taking a prairie technology and implanting it on a southwestern Ontario geography. And for me, that's the problem, because they didn't ever consider that there could be noise issues with these big machines. Mm-hmm. Just introducing them literally overnight to an area that's not used to them. And I think it's no wonder that there's a backlash against it, because it is a pretty huge thing to ask people to accept.
So let's be clear about that point then. Is so far from what you've seen, and I want to, right after this, I'm going to get you just to talk about some of the symptoms and what people have been feeling and, mm-hmm. and what have been reporting. But is this so far, it seems to be that the issue is simply the size of the machines, or is that...
Well, I think increasingly that's the problem. And have you seen the whole thing?
I haven't seen all of it, but I saw about 75% of it. Yeah.
Okay, because at the end we go to Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And in Denmark, this is the home of wind. You know, this is the poster child for wind.
Mm-hmm.
And we have several people saying to us, you know, well, why are they having so much trouble in Ontario when everybody in Denmark's happy with them?
Mm-hmm.
So we went over to Denmark. And what's happened in Denmark is that, as I said, in the 90s they started with these small machines. And they tended to be sort of co-ops, where different communities would have small wind farms within their jurisdiction. Then the wind companies started making the machines bigger and bigger, but they took them offshore because Denmark's so small.
Mm-hmm.
The other imperative in Denmark is that before wind, 100% of their energy was coming from coal. They've got no rivers or waterfalls or anything like that that they can use for hydro, and they're a non-nuclear country. So they're having to import all of their fuel for all of their power. Wind gave them an opportunity for a certain amount of energy independence. So they went offshore into the North Sea, and we went out and filmed on the Horns Rev wind farm, which is pretty impressive. It's 30K offshore, and those machines out there are 2.3 megawatts. The new ones are going to be 3 and up. Vestas is actually working on a 6-meg wind turbine to put out there. But the wind companies started to realize that putting turbines up offshore costs twice as much as putting turbines onshore. You've got to sink pylons and all this stuff. So overnight, they started putting the 2.3 megawatt machines onshore, and immediately you had people complaining about the same symptoms. And now in Denmark, a small country, there are 177 anti-wind groups. So back to your question about, is it size? I think that if you look at the Denmark example, it's size relative to proximity. I think if you got a 3 megawatt wind turbine and put it up offshore, you've got a perfect scenario for generating wind power.
Mm.
But once you take that giant machine to a small country like Denmark and put it right smack dab in between about 4 or 5 small farms, you've got a problem again.
Okay. So one of the main points coming to this, let's start with, if you can just go through what has sort of been reported as the health effects. What are people who are claiming that there has been an effect from wind farm, what are they reporting to their doctors?
Well, in terms of symptoms, they're reporting nausea, headaches, vertigo, and that's how it starts. But on a broader scale, and we talked to scientists in Denmark about this, what they're experiencing is sleeplessness. It all comes down to sleeplessness. And as Norma Schmidt says, that the first couple of nights, okay, a couple of weeks, okay, a couple of months, and then it goes to a couple of years. And we talked to a scientist who's doing work in Aarhus University in Denmark that says what happens with this chronic sleeplessness is that it leads to heart disease, depression, and in some cases diabetes. So it goes on beyond people being grumpy in the morning because they didn't get a good night's sleep. What happens is that chronic sleeplessness leads to very serious health issues. So Norma Schmidt, once again, is sort of the poster child for that, that she's had to move out of her house, she's lost her job, she's not a nurse anymore, her family's fallen apart. I mean, there's all of these horrible issues that have gone around it. And then as you go around, you start finding more and more stories like that. And the wind farms have come in, particularly in Bruce County, and have bought out families that have complained of being sick, but made them sign gag orders so they couldn't talk about it anymore. So there's all these sort of dealings going on that are this side of shady, and you're wondering, okay, well, what's going, you know, why are they doing this? And why are they getting these people to sign gag orders? Why don't they want them to talk about it? You know, these people will talk off camera, and they're talking about the exact same things Norma's talking about, chronic sleeplessness.
And one of my initial reactions when I first heard about when we first started getting reports outside of simply knee jerk, this is crazy hippie technology, you know.
Yeah, yeah, we stay away from all that. We stay away from the NIMBYism.
Yeah.
There are legitimately people who just don't like looking at them.
That was sort of the initial effect before we started getting.
And I think in the Scarborough, in their headline about Scarborough, I really think that was the issue.
Yeah, in that particular case, definitely. I didn't even at the time think that was the entire sort of opposition group, but they obviously do exist. But when we're talking about that sort of, that was the initial knee-jerk reaction. Then health started coming out.
Yeah.
When you're talking to these people, do you find, like, as you said, you made a very clear point about saying that you didn't speak to anyone that you got the impression had any anti-green ideas, and that you intentionally stayed away from the people that were having a NIMBY sort of reaction to this.
Mm-hmm.
The people that you did speak to that were opposing it, like when I heard this problem, my reaction originally when I was hearing the NIMBYism arguments years ago, and that was all that you were hearing,
mm-hmm.
was, well, I'd sure rather that 5% of us, you know, had some restless nights than, you know, 40% of us get cancer from coal. And so therefore that led me to think, well, okay, even if there is an effect here, this is an engineering problem more than it's a policy problem.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find, when you were speaking to folks, did you get the impression that they were interested in sort of fixing this so that we can proceed with it, or that this would turn them off the whole thing and that they think we should drop wind altogether?
They just turn them off the whole thing, because there's a whole bunch of other things that have gone on too that I don't get into in this documentary because it's too big a story. But from the consistent anecdotal stories I've heard is that the wind companies and their leases are very reminiscent of carpetbaggers, that they're coming in and they're promising all this stuff, and farmers are finding that they're very restricted with what they can do on their own property after the turbines go in. But that's a whole other story, and that goes down the road, you know, into another avenue, and you'd end up being on a whole other show. A lot of people don't like how they've been treated by the wind companies. The wind companies also, if you're going to drive around southwestern Ontario and look at the names on the sides of the nacelles, they're almost all owned by Canadian oil and gas companies that all also have interest in the tar sands. And a lot of them are using their investment in wind in Ontario as carbon offsets against the tar sands. So there's all sorts of dealings going on behind the scenes that belie this idea that they're just these perfect white noble instruments that are just going to save the planet. The other thing too is that once the dissatisfaction is in among the population, right? Once people realize that I don't like this because I can't sleep all night because it's noisier and noisier, then they start hearing stuff about how much power does it actually produce? You know, is our grid ready to actually deal with the power coming off these turbines? Who's making the money? Then it just spirals out of control, and you get that sort of unfocused protest movement that I think you mentioned before, that's all over the place, that just kind of scattershot just wants to take the whole industry down because people are angry. And I think the other thing that you can't discount here is the way that the Green Energy Act was designed so that the wind developers can bypass municipalities to deal directly with the province. There were wind developers in Ontario before 2009, and I met some of them, and they said that it was very frustrating trying to get a wind farm going because they had to deal with politicians at the municipal level, and they were just held up for years on end because, quite rightly, these municipalities wanted health studies, and among other things. And the wind developers just basically said, we don't have the time, and we can't afford the investment. With the Green Energy Act, they were given basically a green light that all you have to do is get a one-time approval through the Ontario government, and you don't have to worry about places like Amherst and Merlin and Kincardine because you're pre-approved. So these people feel that their democratic right to defend themselves has been removed. And in many ways, they're right. It has been. And I think that that's something, that's a really bad bit of PR for the provincial government. So, you know, put yourself in the position of a person that's on a family farm. That's their entire investment. Then your neighbor gets a wind lease. The thing is just beyond 550 meters from your house, which is the regulated setback, but a lot of experts say that it's just arbitrary. It has nothing to do with anything.
Well, I think in a lot of cases on a lot of issues, those numbers end up being arbitrary. So.
Yeah, yeah. That's what happens
when you get politicians doing science.
and engineers writing health policy.
Yeah.
That's another issue. And then the next thing you know, you can't sleep, and you've got nowhere to go to complain about it. There's nothing you can do about it. And that is the situation that a lot of these people are finding themselves in. So what, as I say, going way back to the beginning, when I had all of these different issues facing me that were all intriguing on their own right, the idea of, first of all, the health being the nub of it, and then nowhere to turn to once you realize you've got to do something about it, it's no wonder you're seeing people protest. So I don't think they need an umbrella group to get them whipped up, because they're already whipped up, because you're dealing with people's personal property.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very basic idea of society, you know, that something is going horribly wrong next door. I should be able to do something about it. But you can't.
So you obviously, I mean, we've spoken to lots of documentary directors on this show before in the past several years. I'm a big fan of documentaries in general, which is why I like talking to producers and directors of documentaries. But part of that process is essentially that you sort of have to live it. You really get into people's lives and ask them to share their experiences and their personal thoughts with you. So having gone through the experience of producing this film, I'm very interested. We've only got about a minute and a half left here. Just before we go, I want to get sort of now at the end, you've finished. It. It's about to be airing, and I'm sorry, I forgot to write down the actual date that it's airing.
Oh, next Thursday, the 7th on CBC Doc Zone at 9 o'clock, wherever you are.
February 7th at 9 o'clock,
yeah.
CBC Documentary Channel. Thank you.
Main channel, Doc Zone, the show Doc Zone.
Okay. Well, regardless of my stumbling, we will have the accurate information posted on the website afterwards, so if anyone missed that or if you're confused about the back and forth, go ahead and check out the website, greenmajority.ca. That will be up there.
Yeah.
But just before we go then, having lived through that experience, having shared all these people's personal experiences with you, and sort of coming from the point of view of being very skeptical about it, you seem to have implied now that you've somewhat changed your mind. I would like to know that should the decision be up to you, how would you proceed on this issue from here? Is the next step cancel all the projects? Is the next step let's do some research? Where do we go from here, in your opinion?
Well, I think you've got political imperatives, and I think you've got health imperatives. The political imperative is you start canceling these contracts, particularly the $7 billion Samsung plant coming in. You're going to be caught. It's going to cost so much money. I think the Green Energy Act was very poorly written and very poorly thought out. I think that in a lot of instances, the Ontario Agricultural, I can't remember the proper name, but the Farmers Association has called for a moratorium on all wind farms. And this is the association representing people who are financially benefiting from these things. So they've called for a moratorium. I think from a human health point of view, you've got to consider a moratorium. On top of that, and I know we're pressed for time, I think you have to consider where you are in the world and decide what the best form of new green energy is for you, as opposed to importing something that works somewhere else in a completely different topography. Here, I know it's controversial, but nuclear has worked really well for us. It didn't work so well in Japan. For the amount of money that they've put into turbines, there could have been a new reactor. The other thing, and I don't want to open up a whole new line of reasoning, but you can start making our own homes much more energy independent. And of all the studies I've read, what people say the best possible thing we could do is energy conservation, that we could improve how we use electricity and the amount we use by up to 50%. So there's a lot of other things we could be investing in, as opposed to just putting up turbines because they work in the prairies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the kind of take-home point here as well is that what people who are interested in the environmental issues and our listeners and everything, I think this is an excellent point to sort of remind everybody that things are not necessarily, and this doesn't mean that this issue goes one way or the other. We don't know, and I'm someone who's skeptical until I see evidence for anything at all.
Yeah.
And so basically my position on this was there seems to be an effect, but I'm not willing to say that there is until I see a paper on it. But I think what this serves as a good reminder is that something isn't necessarily good just because we've called it green. And that doesn't mean my conclusion goes one way or the other, but I think you've raised an interesting point here that, you know, the idea that something is, we call it green energy, doesn't mean that it should get a sort of free pass, carte blanche necessarily. And then my position on this would be definitely that we need to get some more research before we make decisions either way.
And the last point, the scientists I have in this all have peer review papers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps if there's a way you want to send any of that to me as well, I'd love to link that directly on the thing. I guaranteed this interview will get some comments on our Facebook afterwards. So, and I look forward to hearing people's discussion. If you have any questions or concerns for Andrew Gregg, perhaps if you have any contact information you'd like to give out.
Yeah, sure. You can actually go to my blog. It's just andrewgregg.ca. And CBC is going to have a website up pretty soon. I've written a thing on my blog about this whole, just like what we talked about now. And I normally get letters after a broadcast. I never get anything before. And this has been unbelievable. I'm just getting so much stuff.
Yeah.
It's one of those dinner table things. Mm-hmm. You have a story like this come along every now and again, and you throw it out there at the dinner table, regardless who you're talking to, everybody has an opinion.
Yeah, I guarantee. I want to thank you very much for your time. It was definitely an interesting documentary. I think that regardless of how people feel about the issue, as we can both agree, there definitely needs to be some more information. So I think what people really need to do is they should definitely go and check out the documentary, have a look at it, listen to what people have to say, make up their own minds, and then I think probably at the end of it, everyone's going to agree with you and me that this definitely at least needs to be looked at more seriously.
Oh, there's so much more stuff, and it's almost a shame that the way that the feed-in energy tariff works, so that it encourages wind, because biomass is getting overlooked, and particularly in rural Ontario, what could be done with that is just incredible. You know, so there's a lot of other things that could be developed that aren't being developed because of this fixation on wind.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it, but I want to thank you very much for joining us, Andrew Gregg, producer, writer, and director of documentary Wind Rush, which will be on CBC on the 7th at 9 p.m.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. All right. This has been Green Majority. As I just mentioned, we were speaking to Andrew Gregg there. We're going to go to a short music break, and then we'll be back with some more great stuff right after this. Stay tuned.
If I put my wondering eyes away and stay, I
All right. So I'm Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. We just finished speaking the first pretty much half of the program, but we were having too much fun. I couldn't let him go there. It was Andrew Gregg, the producer, writer, and director of documentary Windrush. Information about that documentary and how to take a look at it and to get another listen at the interview in case you missed it or you came in halfway through. Of course, you want to check out greenmajority.ca. All of our content is posted up there. Each post that I do every week is growing and growing in content. So when we produce the show, we've got longer and longer feeds on there. One of the things you can find on there is links and descriptions of all of the wonderful music that is given to us by DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight music blog. She gives us all the music for the show. All the show music that we play is completely Canadian content because we love Canadian content and due to CRTC rules, but I'd probably have done it anyway. But you can find not only links to the tracks, a lot of the time these are up-and-coming bands, so you'll be able to get free downloads or links, stuff there. She also writes individual reviews of the songs. Other great reasons to go and check out the website, aside from just being able to hear the show again because you can't get enough of my voice, is that we have links to all the articles that we talk about, so I spend some time putting that up. So any of the news items that we talk about, you can find links to all that stuff. There'll be links to his blog up there. We're going to start asking poll questions. So I haven't decided what today's question will be. This was sort of inspired last week because Kevin and I were talking about GMO salmon, and the question I should have put on last week's blog, but we're going to start doing it as of this week. But last week we were talking about GMO salmon versus steaks grown in petri dishes from stem cells. It's kind of a fun topic, but I think it's a very legitimate. So we would have had a poll question based on that. We will endeavor to continue to do that sort of thing in the future. But if you missed that episode as well, that and all the other content is up there on greenmajority.ca every week. We also have a Facebook page where we post lots of interesting content and funny pictures and stuff like that. A lot of news goes up there. Leah and myself and our other volunteers post stuff constantly on there. So almost an overwhelming amount of information, but you can just skim through for the stuff you're interested in. But there's tons and tons of stuff there. All international news, national news, everything gets posted on there. We also do that through our Twitter as well. Twitter tends to be more of just a straight news feed, but lots of great stuff goes up on both. And look forward to more content. Ari Rabinovich, a sort of somewhat long lost volunteer for the program because, you know, he was a total jerk and got like a real job because he wants money or something. I don't know. He's now a radio star. I won't out him on exactly what he's doing, but he is returning for a brief stint. Aria and I will be going to the Canadian International Auto Show in just a couple of weeks. We're going to be taking down a camera. We're going to be doing some interviews. We did interviews last year at the auto show, going in behind enemy lines there, talking to some of the CEOs of some of the major car companies in the country. We spoke to the CEO of Ford last time, among many other car dealers, talking about the green energy incentives, things like hybrids, full electric vehicles. It was very, very cool. It's going to be even cooler this year because we're going to be doing video interviews. So not only will we be doing a Auto Show 2013 episode for the radio program, but we will also be launching our YouTube content that is actually our own content with that as well. There will be a short video produced of clips of us interviewing some of the folks there. You'll get to see some of the stuff that's at the auto show. It's going to be great fun. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm super excited. I know Ari's really excited as well. So stay tuned for that. However, without further ado, I would like to introduce our next guest, which I believe I have on the phone. It is Laura Tozer. Are you there, Laura?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you so much for standing by during my long intro there. But I was very interested in to talk to you. We'd spoken a while ago about a paper that you had coming out, and it has now come out. And I actually didn't even realize at first what a great handoff from the first interview we did this morning. I don't know if you caught it, but we were talking to Andrew Gregg talking about wind turbines. And you're coming to us now to talk about a paper you just released called Community Energy Plans in Canadian Cities, Successes and Barriers in Implementation. So I think that's a perfect transfer over. Do you want to just talk a little bit about your relation to this topic? I have here that you're the Director of Operations for the Community Energy Partnership Programs. You've got several other accreditations next to you. Are you currently, is that your main outlet right now, is through CEPP?
That's right. So through the CEPP, that actually is administered by a not-for-profit organization called the Community Power Fund, and that not-for-profit organization is focused on enabling community-owned renewable energy development. But the research that was behind this paper that came out was a part of my master's research at the University of Toronto, and so that research over about a year was the background to this particular paper, which was focused on municipal community energy planning in Canadian cities, five of them.
So it was released in the International Journal of Justice and Sustainability I have here. Again, it's called Canadian Cities, Successes and Barriers to Implementation. And it was actually very readable. I always sort of chill a little bit when somebody asks me to read a paper, but I actually quite enjoyed yours. It was very well put together. With your permission, we'd like to put a link to it on the show afterwards so people can take a look at your actual paper. But many questions popped up for me. And one of the ones very related to the first interview that we did was the need to correlate adaptation policy to jobs. And that was something that Andrew talked about as well, was that a lot of the farmers were convinced because of the what seemed like an easy paycheck. So I was wondering if we could just start off as far as the issues and barriers to implementing green energy programs, of the need to sell people on the financial gain, that the greenness of it isn't necessarily good enough.
And it's something that's pretty common in climate mitigation policy generally, is people tend to add the co-benefits of pursuing these kind of policies, because what you're getting out of the deal in climate mitigation is often argued for economic development and livability in the community and, the reduction of the impact of coal on air quality and those kind of co-benefits. And that's what is often tagged to these kind of policies that really at their core are trying to get at a more sustainable system. And in this case, I was focused particularly on the energy support systems for a city and how they get their energy and use it in the community, whether it spanning fully from efficiency through conservation, generating their own electricity, but also land use planning and transportation, because what it really came down to is the cities were interested in the greenhouse gas emissions that they were producing as a community.
Now, one of the things that leapt out at me right away, or whenever you're dealing with urban policy and municipal policy, Canada is kind of not a unique case, but there are some special issues here that are specific to Canada, which is that if you've done any academia with relation to planning of any type, policy, you'll hear the language that's used a lot, which is that in Canada, the cities are creatures of the provinces. So it creates an issue here where cities don't necessarily have the ability in many cases to make the sorts of decisions that they like. Can you talk at all about the relationship between cities and provinces in Canada having to do with sustainability?
Sure, yeah. It was something that was very common in my research when I was talking to representatives from the five cities. They had to find pretty imaginative ways of meeting the goals that they had set as a community. In some cases, they were really interested in getting into generating renewable electricity within their borders for their own operations or helping people in the community to build their own projects, but they were actually restricted by the province from getting into producing electricity because of there was a particular company that's owned by the province that pursues that as a public pursuit, and it can't be done by the city itself. And from that straight through to building codes, cities don't have control over the way that the buildings are built in their community. So if they're interested in really progressively pursuing things like efficiency in new buildings because they want to really become the home at cutting-edge work and actual implementation, they actually can't hold builders to a higher standard than what the provincial building code would be. But on the flip side, I mean, you do have the opportunity at the provincial and federal level to implement regulations and policies that completely pave the way for cities to pursue the projects that they want to in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But it's really got to be opened up to let them make that kind of aggressive change.
So not only are there various barriers, and I want to get into some of the barriers more specifically, but there's also various parties, obviously, that are involved here. So giving you an example to start with, say I was an individual and I wanted to generate some solar energy, but my roof wasn't quite big enough. So maybe, say, me and some of my neighbors there sort of agreed that it was a really good idea. Hey, let's pitch in some money and let's get something like this, and we'll share the energy. What sort of issues might someone come across? So what sort of regulations are barriers to individuals or small communities that want to sort of put their own money in and get this started, and it's not for corporate gain, but it's just sort of a sense of community and a small village or something? What sort of barriers would you run into?
And that's the kind of group that we deal with all the time at the Community Power Fund. There's a lot of people that are really interested in pursuing these projects as a social enterprise, and as a cooperative, it's quite common to do a renewable energy cooperative in that way, where it's neighbors sharing investment, making a return on their investment with energy near them that powers their homes and businesses. But the kind of barriers that they run into are can be kind of daunting depending on the size of the project, because it's a lot of money, a lot of capital investment up front, and it's tapping into a complicated arrangement of regulations and policies. So you're crossing planning hurdles, you're, you know, getting permission to officially connect to the electricity grid, you're dealing with engineering issues, and then if you'd like to expand the investment into the project, you've got to market to your other neighbors to get them interested and involved, and then you've got a couple of decades where you're managing a group, a membership, with money invested in a project. So there's a lot of responsibility over time, even after the project is built, to make sure that everyone's getting the returns they're supposed to get, the reporting they're supposed to get, they're able to, you know, sell out and new people to join and that kind of thing. So it's quite a complicated undertaking, and in many cases it's a multi-year effort depending on the size of the project.
So you were, in your study, you were looking at cities all across the country. Did you get any sense of ranking? I mean, I realize you probably can't go sort of down the list in an ordered list or anything like that, but what was your sense from the research that you were doing about better and worse areas where community groups, let's continue with that example, would be able to go about this? Is Ontario, with its green energy program and feed-in tariffs and everything, are they a bastion? Maybe is Alberta a leader? Was there distinct differences between provinces and major cities and in the ability to get this sort of project off the ground for a community group?
At the time when I was doing my research, which was a span of a couple of years ago, the leader was by far the communities that I talked to in Ontario, because of the framework offered by the Green Energy Act. It really does enable these community groups to do these projects that they want to. Now there is a similar policy in Nova Scotia, so I talked to Halifax representatives as well, and they're very enabled to do community projects there. It's specifically for community projects, their feed-in tariff program. And so those were the two places where the community groups specifically were doing quite well. In terms of the city's actions, the city of Vancouver I also spoke with, and because they had been engaging on energy and climate topics for longer than the other cities that I talked to, they were further advanced in enabling all sorts of energy management and energy generation projects, from, you know, things that the municipality was doing to encouraging private business to do in the community to actually helping members of the community do for themselves.
Okay. And so when we're looking at more of a specific situation, let's move on now to kind of the city. One of the things that you outlined in your paper was that there are lots and lots of programs, but one of the issues is that, not necessarily a barrier, but one of the things that isn't being followed through with, is that despite all the programs, there seems to be, compared to the amount of programs, that there's very little assessment and sort of follow-up. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and that's what really brought me to my research, because there's a number of plans floating around for all of these great things that municipalities are planning to do, and they're ratified by council and held up as the goal. And what I was interested in is, I know that a lot of the time these municipal policies, when you go back and check on implementation, they're really struggling with implementing them. And that was what I found for the most part with the five cities in Canada that I talked to about their community energy plans. They had made really great goals a few years ago, but as they moved into the implementation phase, they learned a lot about what they were able to accomplish, and in some cases even their optimism and drive changed, the focus changed in what they were being told to focus on, whether that was by a change in the political oversight or in the bureaucracy. In many cases they were making new departments. So it was really shifting as they moved from the goal-setting phase into the implementation phase.
One of the things that jumped out at me as far as this, I was looking for news stories yesterday, and I came across an article in the Toronto Star talking about how the City of Toronto Councillor Norm Kelly, who's the chair of the Parks and Environment Committee, was saying to a reporter that he doubted climate change was even real. So with someone like that who is not in agreement with the vast 98.9% of scientists on the planet, can you talk a little bit about barriers as far as political barriers, being like policy or just political inertia or just straight up bureaucracy kind of slowing the process versus people actually working against interests as part of the system. What was your feeling was sort of the biggest barrier as far as getting these projects off? Was it inertia or actual like an anti-side fighting it?
One of the things that the participants in my research told me was when they did have success, they consistently pointed to really strong political leadership. So if you have a council or a mayor that is really interested in moving progressively on energy and climate issues, it really drives the agenda through the entire organization. But what they found is across the board, whether or not they had that kind of strong political leadership, was there was a lot of battling against status quo within the department. In many cases, it was seen that these were green, it would be nice to have additional projects that have to come from some other magical pot of money that doesn't exist. And what my participants in the research were talking about is trying to integrate the decision-making for environmental and social purposes into all sorts of different departments, all sorts of different spending decisions, so that infrastructure was not completely inefficient as soon as it was bought, those kind of decisions that were across the board. And that, they found, was very difficult because of the silos in the departments and the fact that these projects have in the past been seen as sort of one-off pilot projects that are just nice to point to. So when there was that strong political leadership at the top, it really gave a message to the entire organization that this is important to our business and our responsibility to our community, and so it should be integrated across the organization.
All right. So unfortunately, we've only got about 4 minutes left, and I have two questions for you. So I just wanted to warn you so you can gauge your answers a little bit. What I'm going to ask you second is that I want you to give me an example of a success, because we're talking a lot about barriers here. But with the last stop on kind of barriers, with respect to the last interview that we did, regardless of where the facts lie on that issue, because as we talked about during that, there still is research that needs to be done. But I want to ask you, with that as an example, with concerns about possible health concerns about things like wind energy and that sort of thing, and this is, I should be clear to our listeners that this is outside of what you actually covered in your paper. I'm sort of asking your personal opinion on this, but is there an implication here that a barrier is necessarily a bad thing? Is there not potentially a concern of too few barriers and steamrolling ahead into something that could have negative effects later? So, and I guess what I'm getting at is in your opinion, from what you've looked at, Is calling something a barrier negative, necessarily negative, or are there good reasons for some of these barriers?
Well, I think what I took away from just to draw on the research to answer the question to start with, what I found was we know, as you mentioned in your entry to the last question, there's overwhelming scientific consensus on climate change and the need to move as quickly as we can as our opportunity for action to prevent runaway climate change that's beyond our control closes. That opportunity, it will not exist forever, and so what we need to do is pursue greenhouse gas emission reductions as quickly as we can. Of course, there's always the responsibility to minimize harm, but what we're talking about in terms of barriers are just inertia and status quo, and it's not in the pursuit of a vision of a city and a Canada that is livable, healthy, and sustainable in all manners of the all meanings of the word.
All right. So just, and I'm sorry to rush you through them, but I really wanted to get to the last question here. And we've only got about a minute and a half left. Can you give me an example that the paper is called Successes and Barriers, or Success and Barriers? So can you talk about some success that you discovered?
Yeah. In Vancouver, they actually were doing quite well in getting to the targets that they had set to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. They had done the Olympics as all the infrastructure investment that needs to go into the Olympics with that kind of framework in mind, so they had really pushed that ahead. And then it was really interesting to talk to cities that were starting to lay the foundation for a whole different local energy system in terms of looking at combined heat and power and district energy and aggressively pursuing efficiency and conservation. So there is success in that kind of transformational change to the local energy system that I think is the goal of planning communities that are sustainable.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid you ended that at perfect timing. Absolutely. You must have been looking at your watch or something. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Laura. We've been waiting for a while to get you on, and I was very excited to read your paper. I want to recommend it to people as well. We will have a link to it on the website after the show. And other than that, thanks so much for joining us. If you have anything else, any other papers, I realize that was a master's thesis, but feel free. Our door is always open. Please contact us.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
All right. So that is unfortunately all the time we have for this week's show. I am Darren Kaster. You have been listening to The Green Majority. We talked to Andrew Gregg, the writer and director of Windrush. At the top of the hour, we were just speaking to Laura Tozer, who's the director of operations for Community Energy Partnership Program, talking about her paper, Canadian Cities, Successes and Barriers in Implementation. That has been The Green Majority. As I said, I'm your host, Darren Kaster. Please check out the website, greenmajority.ca. And other than that, we will see you next week. Thank you very much.